Well, welcome to the Truth Exchange podcast. This is a unique program where we have conversations about worldview, all through the lens of oneism and twoism. This lens is based on Romans 1:25. We exchange the truth of God for the lie, worship and serve creation rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. Amen. I'm your host, Joshua Gilo, and with me is co-host Mary Weller.
Hello, and I'm so happy that now that we have another guest on the podcast today, some of the weirdness behind my walls and nail holes is okay. is blocked. So the split screen's working out real well. Thanks for coming, David.
I had to move my mic or my camera just so everyone could get a nice, beautiful shot of the Enterprise behind me. Our special guest is Dr. David Alexander. He is an associate professor at philosophy at Providence, as well as the president interim. Welcome, David.
Happy to be here. I am no longer the interim president. I am just the vice president for academic affairs and professor of philosophy now.
Excellent. Okay. I'm going to allow you to really tell your story. I'd love to. There's information about you at providencecc.edu. But I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about your story, how you became a Christian, how you got involved with philosophy. That's my background before Truth Exchange. And then how you got involved with Providence, and we'll talk more about Providence later, but let's start with your testimony.
Yeah, so, you know, fair warning to everybody, this is not something I'm used to doing, so probably leave out all sorts of interesting facts here. But so, you know, just very briefly, I was raised in a home, a single parent family. My father left when I was one, just about 2 years old. I had two sisters who were much older than me, a sister that was about 10 years older, another sister about 7 years older. And, you know, our home was fairly tumultuous. We had a mother who did everything she possibly could. She was an incredible mom, worked a ton to provide for us. And nevertheless, you know, my sisters ended up getting pregnant at very early ages. And, you know, they moved out when they were quite young. And so from a pretty early age, I was kind of on my own. Mm-hmm. And like probably a lot of young men, especially during that time, this is late 80s, early 90s, I found my family in my friends. I found my family in the kids I grew up with, the neighborhood that I was from. And then I also, my sister's first husband, my oldest sister's first husband, he played the role in a lot of ways of my father. And, you know, unbeknownst to her and the rest of us, it turned out he was a criminal. So he did some things that were really good for me. He got me into sports. He literally taught me how to shave. But he also did some things that were pretty destructive, and so got me involved in all sorts of bad behavior, introduced me to a lot of debilitating behaviors, habits that, especially for, you know, prepubescent and then postpubescent young man, are incredibly destructive. Mm-hmm. And so I lived a pretty bad life for quite some time. So got involved in various criminal activity, you know, substance use, all of those sorts of things, and also, you know, promiscuity. That was sort of how I lived for quite some time. And then, you know, there were all sorts of other people involved in my life, who, you know, would speak into it with wisdom, with love, try to provide direction. My mom was close to a family. The husband was a Reformed Episcopal priest.
Okay.
And so he ended up playing a kind of fatherly role. I'll never forget one day, just quick story, I'll never forget one day, me and a bunch of friends are in like a local pizza place playing video games, doing stupid stuff. And the priest came up to us and he singled out two of us, myself and another friend of mine. And, you know, we knew him. He's wearing a collar. He's just a unbelievably kind, loving, gentle, but very frank, blunt man. And so he comes up to us and he says, "Hey, I want to let you guys know I'm praying for you." And, you know, we kind of probably said something stupid and rude and disrespectful to him just to be fun, just to be funny.
Yeah.
With our friend group. And he says, "And I also want you to know that I'm praying that if it would help you, that God would send you to prison." So I still am very close to this man. So every time I see him, I think I recount that story to him.
Is he still in the Episcopal Church, or is he?
He is.
Okay.
He is.
Okay.
So his name is Dr. Reverend Stephen Rutt. And amazing man. But that shook me kind of to my core. You know, I had this this idea, right, that a priest, you know, a kind of sacerdotalism is not how I understand it now.
Right.
That a priest has this sort of direct line to God.
Right.
And so if the priest is asking God to do X, X is going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, that stands out. I didn't convert at the moment,
sure.
But a number of years later, I went through a lot of difficulty. I moved out of my home when I was still in high school, had an apartment in an even worse part of Phoenix, Arizona.
Okay.
And during that time, there were just a lot of things that went very, very badly. Experienced a lot of violence. One of my close friends was murdered. And then right around the same time, the first woman I ever loved broke up with me. And so those two things, there had been a series of things, but those two things just rocked my world.
Yeah. What part of Phoenix were you in?
So this would have been around Glendale, Peoria, and then just Phoenix proper.
Okay. My wife is from Gilbert.
Had no familiarity with Gilbert
okay.
growing up. That was like farm country.
That's right.
So yeah, we would have never
crossed lines.
Opened the door of Gilbert. Yeah. So anyway, all that's going on. And for about a year or a year and a half, I had been really struggling with meaninglessness. That life has no meaning. Death was sort of all around me in various ways. By the time I was 21 years old, I had attended 20 funerals. And so, you know, I mean, it just sort of saturated my life. It was all around me.
Yeah.
So my death was on my mind all the time. And I just remember distinctly thinking that if life has no meaning, no purpose, then I can behave however I want.
Sure.
It doesn't matter. I can invent it. Right. I get to invent what the purpose is. I get to invent what the meaning of life is. And I can invent it in such a way that it's all about me and not about anybody else and do whatever it is that I want to do. Then I went through those incidences, right, where a very, very close friend of mine was killed. And then this breakup. And my reaction to those events didn't track meaninglessness. I couldn't make sense of the heartbreak,
yeah,
the pain that I felt if life was meaningless. I could make sense of it if life was meaningful. So making a long story short, I cried out to God one day and I met him. Jesus, the Holy Spirit, came to me. I mean, not to be too graphic, but I think this sort of illustrates God's love in pretty powerful ways. I was in the shower sobbing as a young man, about 20, 21 years old, and just crying out to God. And I entered the shower physically dirty and spiritually dirty, and I left the shower physically and spiritually clean. So I met Jesus that day for the very first time.
Wow.
And since then, you know, I've been attempting to follow him. I wish I could say that, you know, I've never sinned again, right? That I've followed him perfectly since then, you know, but obviously, of course, I can't say such a thing.
What is your theological tradition right now? Are you Episcopal or?
I did end up going to, for about a year, to the Reformed Episcopal Seminary. They planted a satellite campus in Phoenix for a time. And so I attended that for about a year, but I am currently PCA.
Okay. In 2007, I was going to train to be an Episcopal priest. But then I went the way of Reformed Baptist and then Presbyterian.
You forgot the street preacher part.
That's when I was yeah, I was transferring into the Reformed Baptist. But yeah, I did Mary's hat tip into I did. There was a season where I was doing a lot of street preaching, specifically at the UC campuses, UCSD, UCLA, UC Berkeley, and So during this time of your conversion, were you in school? Were you studying philosophy already, or?
Yeah. So, you know, philosophy plays a fascinating role, right? You know, God in, I perhaps arrogantly, egoistically sort of think of myself as like the dumber, smaller, sort of Augustine, right? Like in terms of his life. You know, my mom prayed for me every day, but I wanted nothing to do with anything that she loved and that she appreciated.
Your mom was a believer, David?
My mom is a Jewish believer in Yeshua. So, yes, my mom is a believer. And she just celebrated her 80th birthday. They handed me a mic to say something about her in the one thing I said is my mom introduced me to Jesus. But as a kid, I didn't want anything to do with anything that she was associated with. I blamed her a lot for my family situation. My mom and I are very, very tight now. So
is she in Arizona still, or is she in California?
She's in Arizona. I'm actually heading to see her later this evening.
Okay. A long trek down. You're up in Pasadena. I was gonna say you're not gonna take the 8 then.
No, I'm flying out actually, but the drive is not bad. So philosophically, I actually ended up sort of dropping out, being kicked out. You know, I don't remember actually all the details here, but of high school for a time. And you know, again, in God's incredible grace, I was actually able to graduate on time. I had some high school teachers who came alongside me and said they wanted me to finish. So I dropped out for a time. I came back, and ended up having to go to school for a very, very long time, like hours per day in order to finish. But I had some teachers who probably actually changed grades for me in order to allow me to graduate. It was during this time at the school, the public school that I went to, they had a class for all of the delinquent kids. So all of the kids who were in serious trouble, who, you know, broke the rules, had to be monitored constantly. They had this class for us, and it was taught by two of the most gregarious, popular high school teachers. And they were these two weird old hippie guys who were just dynamic, though. And so they taught this class, and the class actually, it functioned as just a standard humanities class. So we did art, history, and philosophy. And I got interested in philosophy during this time. And, you know, when I got hit with that bug, I got bit by the philosophy bug. You know, I've never been able to extract it. So during this time where I'm going through this year and a half, I don't remember how long, year and a half or so of meaninglessness, darkness, surrounded by death, I'm actually reading a bunch of philosophy too, but I don't know what I'm doing. I'm reading a bunch of garbage, pop philosophy. I'm reading a bunch of decent philosophy too, but when I converted, when I became a follower of Jesus, I knew that I was going to major in philosophy. So when I went to college, I ended up going to college, you know, later than most, a couple of years after high school. But I knew before I ever stepped foot on a college campus that I was going to focus in philosophy. My route to Providence is also, you know, interesting and relevant, I think, to the details, the heart and soul of this podcast, I think. So I was a professor of philosophy at a couple of other Christian liberal arts colleges before I came to Providence. And during that time, my dissatisfaction with the state of Christian higher ed was just increasing and increasing and increasing for two reasons. One, I think, is an obvious reason: cultural creep. The culture was creeping into the halls of Christian higher education in discernible and indiscernible ways. So, you know, LGBTQ, a hyper focus on race and all of those sorts of things ended up happening at the institutions that I was previously employed at. And, you know, the administration and the board at those colleges, I think, were solid. As far as I know, they were solid, but the colleges were so large, right? Not massive institutions. One was about 4,000. The other one was about 1,500 students. But that's big enough to not be able to know what's happening on the ground day by day, week by week, month by month. So we had departments in those institutions that were solid, but departments that were not, that were actively attempting to deconstruct young person's faith. These professors would have called themselves Christian, but they were clearly progressive Christians who loved to shock their students out of their dated traditional Orthodox Christianity. That was happening over and over. Also, for me, another sign of the decline of Christian higher education, at least at the institutions that I was associated with, was the demise of the Christian liberal arts. And so the reason I say that is because when the liberal arts start taking a backseat to everything else, usually the story behind that is that the college is after students, they're after numbers, right? And look, we all understand the Christian liberal arts don't typically attract massive numbers. So as colleges are, you know, they've got this business model where they need to constantly grow in order to survive. So they've got to get more and more kids in. So as they get more, in order to do that, they need to have flashier, sexier academic programs. Hmm. So in order to house those academic programs, they've got to eliminate or reduce a number of the classes that they require. Well, what gets hit? The liberal arts. What's the impact? Well, at a Christian institution, the liberal arts, the Christian liberal arts, are where you get that grounding, that foundation, that depth of understanding of the Christian faith and how it applies to everything. Mm-hmm. In the more pre-professional, vocational-like departments, and I'm not against those in any way, but in those programs, they do not have the time. Sometimes they're overseen by external agencies. Yeah. So they've got a bunch of requirements, right? To be an engineer, to be a nurse, to be a social worker, all of those things, they have to have a bunch of classes and they have to go through a bunch of content. If the students have a solid foundation in the Christian liberal arts, then they themselves can learn how to interpret what they're getting in engineering and nursing and in social science and education, in all of those things. But if they don't have that, then their only introduction to understanding their field of study from a Christian perspective is going to be within those fields of study. And unfortunately, those fields of study are the ones that get saturated with a lot of progressive Christians.
Okay.
So the decline of the liberal art is actually a signal to a decline in the seriousness with which the institution takes the faith and takes integrating the faith into every single solitary thing that it does. It's also, one last thing here, it's also a sign that the institution sees itself primarily as transactional.
Okay.
You are here to get an education, to get a job. So if the Christian institution sees itself as primarily in the job hunting, job getting business, then it's going to stop seeing itself as in the discipling business.
Okay.
Right? And so it's a very subtle but unbelievably important shift in the mission of the institution. So I'm seeing this, I'm witnessing this in the colleges that I'm associated with. And for a number of years, my wife and I were praying about whether I should actually just leave Christian higher education altogether. We were actually staying, I have a number of family members in Mexico City, and we were staying with them one summer. And a job opportunity at Providence Christian College somehow got into my inbox, and I'd never heard of the college. I clicked on it, had nice, shiny, you know, website, and said all the right things about its commitment to the Christian liberal arts. But I thought I'd do a deep dive. And as I did that deep dive, I realized that this institution really was serious about what it said, right? So there's a lot of disconnect between the advertising materials and the reality on the ground at most places, right? Providence, as I investigated more and more, it seemed to me that there really was no disconnect between who it said it was and who it actually was attempting to be. And, you know, ended up here shortly thereafter, right in the middle of COVID. My wife and I moved halfway across the country, and we've been here ever since.
Okay. Before we get into what Providence says it was and what it is and the details of that, I'd love to talk with you about a couple of things. One is, if you could sketch for our listeners what you perceive, your finger on the pulse of the culture, as it were, of what are the issues young people are facing, and then what kind of issues are they bringing into the college sphere or the educational sphere? And is that affecting the way that colleges do education?
Great question, Joshua.
Yeah, really good question. Hopefully I can hit both of those, but if I don't, please just remind me. I sometimes tell a story to like visiting families, visiting students and their parents. I don't do this one very often, but I think it's illustrative of some of what's happening in our culture. So if someone is lost, like in the middle of the desert, or someone is lost in the middle of a forest, like survivalists and people who study this will tell you that I think it's like the number one thing people do once they discover they're lost in the middle of nowhere. Do you know what people tend to do?
Backtrack?
No. So what they end up doing is they run around. They will just shoot off in all sorts of directions. And, you know, they'll run in one direction and not, and then, you know, realize that this isn't getting them anywhere. Then they'll run in another direction, realize it's not getting them anywhere, run in another direction, realize, and they'll do this for a long period of time. And that actually increases the likelihood that they'll never be found or that they'll never get out alive.
Wow.
I think that's analogous to what's happening in our culture, that we live in a lost culture and our students are growing up in a lost culture. Many young people, not actually Providence students, thank the Lord, but many, many young people, more and more young people are growing up in a culture that isn't providing them with direction. It isn't pointing them to something of substance, something that has deep meaning and purpose.
Yeah.
And so guess what they're doing? They're behaving like people lost in the desert or lost in the forest. They're running in 1,000 different directions and grabbing a hold of anything that can provide them with a little stability for a moment. So that's the sort of general picture. That's kind of how I think about what's happening here. You know, in terms of kind of real issues, I mean, we can see this just by we could start just checking off all of the hot button issues that you can find on social media, right? So, I mean, the LGBTQ stuff, I mean, those are issues that young people are definitely grappling with. I think we're seeing a turning, you know, a lot of people are thinking that we're on the transgender mania is on the decline. I certainly hope that's the case. But, you know, a lot of stuff grappling with that. How do we love LGBTQ persons or persons who identify in that way or behave in that way? How do we love them? And I think there's a lot of difficulty with figuring out how to love someone that you disagree with and disagree about something that they consider fundamental to their identity. Absolutely. Right? I think that's also a crucial issue. How do I disagree? How do I love while disagreeing with things that people, you know, deeply identify with? I think those are some issues that a lot of Christian young people are facing. I mean, uncertainty about their futures, right? Uncertainty with respect to the job market, right? We're hearing a lot about the affordability crisis. I think we're seeing that. I think we're also, you know, seeing a lot of young people coming into colleges less and less prepared, right? So their K through 12 education is not preparing them. The University of California, San Diego just released a 51-page fascinating report on how just a ridiculous amount of their students come in with less than elementary age competency in mathematics, reading, and writing. This is UCSD. UCSD is a flagship university in California, and a high percentage of their students can't add fractions and can't parse, can't comprehend a paragraph.
To put some numbers on this just really quickly, my husband's been reading through that report because he sits on the public high school board here in our community. And we were seeing numbers and results coming out of our district here in Southern California, where at, you know, just off the top of my head, one particular school, it's a high school, 8% of the students are at grade level for math. 8%,
that's wild.
Right? And those are the prime students then that are supposed to be feeding into these UC schools. And so it is systemically disastrous. Mm. So I just want to highlight that what you're talking about, David, for our listeners, that, and California is not an outlier, right? It's not an outlier. This is a nationwide issue that we're dealing with. So sorry for the insertion.
No, that's great. Thank you, Mary, for bringing that.
No, California is a bellwether, actually.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah, it is.
A bellwether for the rest of the country, and it's happening all over. And this sort of gets into maybe my next point here, actually, is that, you know, during COVID, I think a lot of people, a lot of parents realized that their children weren't being educated, right? They were being indoctrinated. They were being, courted, right, towards activism. So like in my head, I've got these like four different models for education. So one model is the job market model, right? And you get an education in order to get a good job, in order to live a comfortable life. But if the comfortable life looks more and more out of reach, that model for education is going to need to be tweaked, right? It's going to need to be adjusted. But that's probably the dominant model in our country right now, the job market model. You've got another model, right? The knowledge model. This is the so-called like German education model, German research university model. All we want is knowledge, right? Gather more and more facts. We want to learn more and more facts. But notice that that model is not the wisdom model. That's just get a bunch of knowledge, get a bunch of facts, and then we don't know really what to do with them. What do they connect to, right? How do we put them together into a coherent story? And so there you get, well, there's no such thing as inherent intrinsic meaning or purpose, so you can kind of make it up and do whatever you want. Now enter into that the what I would call sort of activist model for education that has come to be, I think, a lot more dominant than people realized. I think COVID uncovered a lot of that for a lot of people, even at the K through 12 levels. teachers were soliciting, right? They were indoctrinating their students to become social activists. And so you've got that. That's a new model, I think. Maybe not. Maybe it's always been there. We just didn't know what to label it. It wasn't as explicit. But you've got the social activism model for education, where we don't care if they actually know math or know how to read or know how to write in, you know, a mature, sophisticated way, so long as they can scream and yell and hold up a picket sign and they adopt the political social views that the progressives
have adopted. It truly is a Freirean model of, you know, even the vocabulary that children are being taught. You see this, you mentioned the LGBTQ, where there are alphabet books for toddlers that where like in ABC, the word they learn is no longer aunt, it's activist. That, you know, the B that they learn is BIPOC. You know, it's amazing to see how even at the pre-K level, this truly is what's happening. And we've seen the disastrous results of that elsewhere, but we have imbibed that model here. So, yeah.
In one sense, right, I'm grateful to the uncovering of this. I'm grateful that it's more explicit than it's ever been. Like I said, I think this has been going on for quite some time. It was just more implicit. It was hidden from even the kids who were being indoctrinated, right? I mean, you couldn't quite tell. Now, right, all of the gloves are off, so to speak, and it's just much more explicit. So that's the third model. And then I would say the fourth model for education is wisdom. The wisdom model is the one, obviously, I favor. So I think that's an issue, right, is that you've got a lot of kids who are coming out of K through 12 and they're not prepared for college. And then what's going to happen to the colleges? Either they're going to end up having to kick out, right? Those kids are going to end up, failing out, flunking out of those institutions because they maintain their standards, or they're going to radically revise their standards in order to get them through. And then we're going to have a bunch of people who have bachelor's degrees or master's degrees, and that certificate, that title means nothing, right? It will end up meaning a lot less. So either way, we are between a rock and a hard place when it comes to, I think, education. I'm excited to see a massive increase in Christian K through 12, in classical Christian K through 12. I think all of that is exciting. And my hope is that more and more people are going to support those endeavors. If we don't, the public school system isn't going to fix itself. Right. I don't see that changing anytime soon. So if we don't push a bunch of resources, excellent teachers, money, students into solid Christian K through 12 education, solid Christian classical education, we're going to continue to experience the disruptions we've been experiencing over the last, 15, 20 years.
Yeah. So to follow up on the questions that Joshua asked, and to summarize a little bit, that is the pulse of the culture, because that's how our children culturally are being educated. And so would you say then, do you have students who come in even at Providence, but that you saw in your other teaching positions who maybe didn't even realize that they were activists, that they had been trained that way, that the foundation under their feet up until that point really had been this model that was causing them to process, react, and think about things in the way that they had. Like, I would assume there are kids who come in who think that they're coming to a Christian college because they are Christians and don't even realize the way that they have been programmed previously.
Absolutely. I mean, it was way more prominent at my previous institutions. The previous institutions that I was at were not covenantal colleges. So that means they allowed in non-Christian students. I've got no problem with that model, right? I mean, we need good, solid Christian institutions, Christian universities that allow non-Christian students to come in. But what that does is, as their numbers increase, that means the curriculum has to change, right? You get a lot more people who are like biblically illiterate, Christian history illiterate. And so you've got to change, the curriculum in order to match the level of understanding, education, competencies of the students that are coming in. So a lot of students, right? I mean, at some of my previous institutions, every single year, there were students who were trying to get LGBTQ clubs started. They were almost always successful. They either did it underground and certain professors would sponsor it underground, or they did it above ground and the college endorsed it or the college allowed it. Providence, it's much less so. The majority of our students are actually coming out of homeschool and classical Christian school K through 12 educations. And so they're not exposed as much to that stuff. Now, it's all over our culture. So you and I don't even realize, I think, how much we have been infected with some of those inclinations, some of those ways of framing and thinking about things. You know, we politicize everything. And so, you know, I think the politicization of everything is part and parcel to what we're talking about here. I think we're actually seeing this on the right. I hate to say this, but, you know, I'm a conservative. I don't think the Republican Party is a conservative party necessarily. I think that's kind of obvious, right? I mean, but I think we're seeing, you know, I could be way off here, but I'm not a political philosopher. I'm not a political scientist. So what I'm about to say, you know, needs lots of scare quotes. But, you know, in my read, the politicization of everything, the hyper-focus on activism and all of that really was dominated by the progressive left. And I now see a kind of, you know, what do they call it? The radical right or whatever, doing the same sort of thing. And so I think as conservative believers, we're actually going to need to pay a lot of attention to that, because any idol will destroy you. Any idol will kill you, whether it's, you know, the idol of sex, the idol of gender, the idol of money, or the idol of politics. And so, I want to pay attention to those things. But the students at Providence have really, I mean, in just one of the most fortunate ways, the vast majority of them don't really seem to have any of those inclinations.
My big reveal here is that I am a parent of a Providence student, and I'm also now amazed and honored to be a part of the Providence Christian College Board. And so I will echo what you're saying about this, David, just having seen our eldest daughter go through the program at Providence. You know, we had 1 year of community college to go through with her. So not a huge, huge picture when she first went in at Providence, but at least enough of a snapshot for us to really be able to compare the vast difference between the philosophy that underlies the education she was getting at the community college, which is it's a renowned community college. It's a very good one. And between that and the instruction and the formation and the discipleship that she has received at Providence, it is an entirely different world. And it's been interesting because every year as she's working on papers and working through classes, particularly when she's in with Eumenes, for whatever reason, whom she just adores, she comes back and I see her and have engaged with her as she has thought back over her experiences, in particular in a writing class that she went through at the community college, and has begun to understand the philosophy of the professor, who was very encouraging to her, but has begun to understand it more clearly, to understand that the ideas that were driving the things that he was teaching and the way that he was thinking them, teaching them, because of her experiences at Providence. And so the formation and the discipleship and the wisdom gain, both on a personal level, and I'm making a separation between personal and educational. There's a lot of overlap there, but in her personal life, but then in the way that she approaches education and approaches her thoughts about policy, because that's what she wants to be involved in after graduation, it has been amazing. It has been one of those things, especially this year, as the college has made some changes and improvements to things that you guys were assessing before, and that speaks to the size of the college, your ability to really personally interact with these kids and understand what's going on. I cannot tell you how many nights Bob and I have been in bed, and as we have thanked the Lord, one of the things that we've thanked him and praised him for is what's happened with her at Providence Christian College. So just to put pin on that, or a pin in that, you know, we really have seen that difference and experienced that difference in our family.
I mean, I tell people all the time, and I really mean it, that if I could go back in time and choose a different undergraduate institution, I really would choose Providence. The funny thing is, right, I mean, back then, of course, I'd have to be a different human being, right? I'd have to have been had a different mindset, a different set of values and desires at that time. But, you know, we often don't know what we really need, right? We're often just deeply mistaken about what we actually need. And, you know, prior to coming to Providence, prior to, you know, leaving my previous institutions and coming to Providence, I would have never said that I think, you know, the ideal size of a college is 100 students, 200 students, something. I would have never thought that. I would have thought you're crazy. That sounds absurd. Now, after having lived it, I mean, I it's hard for me to deny, right, that what I see happening here in terms of, now a lot of this has to do with the people we have, right? I mean, our professors are to a person unbelievably competent and faithful and involved. And so a lot of it does have to do with who you've got, but we can monitor who we've got because we're so small, right? I mean, we know what's happening day to day, hour by hour. And because of that, I mean, the involvement of professors in students' lives is off the charts. The involvement of students with one another is off the charts. My wife and I live in the same space the students live in. Every single night, the students are running around the apartment complex that Providence Christian College runs, and they're singing, and they're laughing, and they're dancing, and they're having deep theological, philosophical conversations, you know, till midnight or later, engaging in this deep, rich community that you can have that at massive institutions, but what you end up having is you have, right, they're not integrated, right? So you've got like this mini college at this massive institution, and that mini college can function completely independently of the massive institution. That's actually not healthy. So what we can do at a small college is just, you can't do it at the bigger colleges. The bigger colleges can do stuff we can't do. They can have climbing walls, and they can have amazing Olympic-sized pools and state-of-the-art exercise rooms and stadiums and all of those things. We can't do any of that. But we can develop people, I think, in ways I've honestly just never seen it in higher education. And I'm now just a huge defender of a small institution, small residential institution.
Talk to us about the wisdom model. And as you're doing that and setting that up, could you also address institutions, colleges, the higher education that has faculty and administration that's progressive versus a Christian liberal arts institution that teaches about these things and teaches, engages young minds to engage, but to combat?
Yeah, very good. Hopefully I answer this. If I don't, please tell me, hey, you got off on a rabbit trail here. So, Yeah, look, you know, the wisdom model, it seems to me, right? I mean, look, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, right? I mean, Proverbs 8 is one of my favorite chapters in all of Scripture, right? You know, wisdom, Jesus Christ embodies, he's wisdom incarnate, right? And so you only get deep, true wisdom as you grow in your love and commitment to Christ, right? I mean, that's where deep wisdom is. I do think there is such a thing, and maybe, you know, charge me with heresy. I do think there is such a thing as a kind of secular wisdom, right? Secularist. Plato has wisdom. Socrates has wisdom. Aristotle has wisdom. The pagans can have insight into all sorts of things, but you don't get like the full picture, the depth of it, what it all points to until you get to Christ, right? And so the wisdom model of education, I think what it, the whole, putting it super simply, is the wisdom model of education seeks to ensure that the most important values are taught as the most important and the least important are taught as the least important, right? That our value structures match reality, right? And so the wisdom model for education is going to say the most important thing in your life is knowing God, right? Think of Jesus Christ's high priestly prayer in John 17, and this is eternal life, that they may know him and Jesus Christ whom he has sent, right? That's eternal life, right? That's the goal. The goal is to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. That's the goal. So the wisdom model says that's the goal. And we're gonna educate in such a way that we point students to that. So the value structure of the education has to match the value structure of the universe. If it doesn't, you are going to subtly, or maybe not so subtly, replace, you're gonna pervert, distort the value structure of God's creation, the value structure of reality. And so the job market model ends up distorting that, because subtly, implicitly, or maybe explicitly, what does it train you to do? It trains you to think that getting a job, making lots of money, and having a comfortable life is the most important thing. So everything revolves around that. The wisdom model says, no, everything has to revolve around knowing God and Jesus Christ, whom he has sent. Everything has to revolve around loving God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and loving your neighbor as yourself. So we want our students to know math in a deep, deep way, but I want them to know math in such a way that math itself, our thoughts about math, math is understood as revealing God in deep ways. Same with anatomy and physiology, same with physics and chemistry, same with psychology and politics, all of those sorts of things. Now, Providence doesn't pretend that we have the answers to all of that. We don't know exactly what that looks like, but we are committed to keeping that as the ultimate goal. That's the ultimate goal for your life, so it's got to be the ultimate goal for your education. It's the ultimate goal for your eating. It's the ultimate goal for your drinking, right? Whether you eat or drink or whatsoever you do, do it all to the glory of God. How do I eat and drink to the glory of God, right? I want to figure that out, and I want to talk about it. How do I spend to the glory of God? How do I consume to the glory of God? How do I listen and look at things to the glory of God? I don't know all of the answers, but I want to.
It's a two-ist way of doing education.
You just said exactly what I was thinking. And Joshua, it is a truly two-ist model of education. And as you're speaking, David, the question I've asked myself almost from the very beginning of discovering Providence Christian College, and I remember vividly the moment that I first heard about Providence. And then within a month or two of hearing about Providence, finding out that Dr. Jones had been invited to come and present at a chapel at Providence. Mm-hmm. And I remember where I was standing in the chapel, and I remember wondering a thing and praying a thing. One was, dear Lord, please get our daughter here. This particular mm-hmm. daughter was mm-hmm. the one I knew needed Providence. And he, in his graciousness, has done that. But the other thing that I was so aware of was that somehow, here's Dr. Jones. I think he was 82 years old. He just celebrated his 85th birthday last week. But I think he was about 82 years old. Somehow, this student body sitting in chapel very attentively, more attentive than I had ever seen a chapel before, had been prepared to understand the message that Dr. Jones delivered for that chapel in a way where there was no blowing off of the elderly British gentleman. There was no thinking that what he was talking about was irrelevant to their lives or to the things that they were learning here at college. They understood that it was a perfect complement. And what he produced was, you know, a presentation of oneism and twoism having to do specifically with sexuality. He was touching on the LGBTQ issues. And I was thinking, how are these kids so able to understand so deeply what Dr. Jones is presenting? And I understand now, you know, as you've been talking, I'm thinking back through Romans 1, starting with verse 16, all the way through the end, that Paul shows in 1:25, they've exchanged the truth about God for the lie. They worshiped and served created things rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. Amen. And you are teaching your students in what we call that purely twoist model, that there is always the authoritative Creator God who came in the flesh to save his people. Always, that is the reality that all
and redeem
and redeemer. Yeah, Creator and Redeemer. That has to be central to our understanding of every other piece of knowledge that we pick up. And what Paul shows through that entire chapter is that in any way, when we exchange that ultimate reality and we worship and serve anything else, our ability to think, our ability to reason, our ability to understand ourselves properly as sexual beings made male and female in his image, all of the rest of it unravels. All of the rest of it ends up in devastation. And so in your explanation of what you guys are doing at Providence, I finally have been able to understand why the marriage of Providence with Truth Exchange. I saw it again when we held our symposium in August of last year at Providence, and so many of your students attended, why they were so able to take and run with the lectures that they heard and received there. It's because of the twoist preparation. You guys don't use those terms the way that we do, but it is because of that twoist educational model that is distinct throughout everything that I see you guys do. And now that I have seen some of it from the inside, both as a parent and as a board member, I just reaffirm that it's a coherent model. It is the most coherent model of doing that I have ever seen, and I'm so thankful for it. So, sorry, I got really excited.
No, I love that. I mean, I love that. I mean, I remember meeting Dr. Jones. I remember his talk that he gave. I remember the panel, the talk that he gave at Truth Exchange. I remember the panel discussion there. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you are absolutely right. You know, at a fundamental level, it's either creature only or creator and creature. And once you know, the creature only model, right, that this is all there is, this sort of goes back to kind of what we were saying earlier. I mean, that's just going to naturally result in the person lost in the middle of the desert or the middle of the forest, right, hunting after something to hold on to, right, that isn't going to, like sand, right, you know, run through all my fingers, or water, you know, that I can't actually get a grip on it. And so you just run from everything and everything. And this is what we're seeing in our culture. This just running after anything to provide me with stability and meaning and purpose. And it's terrifying, but it's also, I'm convinced we are in a place where Christianity, the message of Christ, the message of the gospel, I think can hit right now in ways that maybe it couldn't have 20, 30, 40
100%. Amen to that. I use this example. I think I was actually speaking to a couple of the other board members about it this weekend, David. But the detransitioners that I have worked with and had a chance to get to know a little bit, that so many of them are claiming Christ now, where they had come from completely unbelieving, pagan, secular backgrounds. But when they ran up against the immutable nature of their sexed bodies, throwing everything that medical technology and philosophy and social changes, you know, tried to undergird, and they ran up against the immutability of their femaleness or their maleness, so many of them have started to long then in that darkness and in that damage to know the one who made them that way, and then to worship him. And so it's very interesting as we flail. I think about Christ talking about building your house on the rock or building your house on the sand. And so many people in our culture are dwelling in houses that were built on the sand that are crumbling all around them. And it makes them long for the solidity of the rock. They used to reject it because they thought that they could make it for themselves, but they long for that firm foundation because they understand the danger. They have experienced the danger of having dwelt in a house that was built on something else. So I'm mixing tons of metaphors, but
our Lord and Savior does too. So you're allowed. I love all of that. I think as this stuff becomes more and more dominant, I think Christians have an incredible opportunity. As you were talking, I was reminded there was a time at my previous university, I was teaching like a intro to philosophy class. And in the intro to philosophy class, it might have been intro to ethics, but anyway, in that class, we go through some philosophy of sex, philosophy of marriage, some of that kind of stuff. And, you know, we're talking about it, we're reading some stuff on it. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I expose our students here at Providence and at other institutions to all sorts of different perspectives, right? We want to understand them in a deep way, right? We have to. I think we owe it. I think love requires it. Love requires that I understand my neighbor. And my neighbor often is someone who completely rejects as you all are putting it, the truest understanding of the universe, the truest understanding of reality. So I owe it to them. Love requires me to understand where they're coming from. So anyway, in this class, I just distinctly remember this. We're talking about this stuff. And for whatever reason, I said, you know, from a Christian understanding of sex, gender, marriage, love requires love. I'm loving a transgendered person. I'm loving an LGBTQ person, someone who's engaged in that behavior, by telling them that that behavior is destructive. If Christianity is true, love requires me to do it. That's the loving thing to do. This is a loving message, and it's a destructive, harmful, deeply harmful message from the LGBTQ community, if Christianity is true. They're actually destroying you. And for some reason, a bunch of the students in my class, like a light bulb went off. They had been seeing the Christian position as being the unloving one, and the LGBTQ position as being the loving one because it's so tolerant. But they finally realized, okay, but if the Christian understanding of the universe is true, then this is going to ruin you. This will destroy you. And we're seeing the destructive impact of it. It's unavoidable, as you were pointing out.
Absolutely. Faithful are the wounds of a friend and profuse are the kisses of an enemy. Those kisses are meant to destroy you. They feel good in the moment, but an enemy is not someone who simply is passive. An enemy is seeking your destruction, and they are doing it by profusely kissing you, right? And a friend comes. Well, I think of your Episcopalian priest friend that you were talking about at the beginning. Yeah. I'm praying that God might send you to prison if you need that, right? It hurt, right? It shook you to hear that, but that was true love. Mm. And that light bulb moment, David, that you're talking about, I was invited so graciously, and it was such an honor, by a group called Clergy United in Southern Illinois. They're in Monroe County, right outside of St. Louis. It's a cross-denominational group of pastors who recognized that they needed to answer this LGBTQ plus ideology and religion, with the truth of Christianity. And when I spoke at this event, there were about 50 kids in the, I think, 400, 450 people who were there who were of high school and college age. And I had that same experience where in presenting both what the biblical definition of love entails, which is truth-telling, right? It rejoices in the truth and it does not rejoice in wrongdoing. In presenting to them also the hierarchy of those great commandments, that you love the Lord first with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, then you love your neighbor as yourself, submitted to first that love of God, the Creator and Redeemer. And then presented the reality of the psychological effects of social transition on children and adults, the locking in that it does, the damage of the medical procedures and the prescriptions that are provided to people. My line afterwards, like the speaker line to talk to people who had come to the event, was distinctly made up of college age and high school age kids who had been convicted by the fact that they had been kissing their friends in a destructive manner rather than wounding their friends in a loving manner. And we're suddenly considering the sacrifice of reputation, the sacrifice of social standing, the sacrifice of being ostracized, and maybe even losing those friendships. But they were considering the weight of glory involved in going to those friends, repenting of having lied to them in false love, and beginning to deal with them in the truth, and to see those lights go on. Like, this might be the first time I've ever talked about it without landing in a puddle of tears. It was the most humbling, beautiful experience I've had. Of seeing those lights turn on and seeing like the humility. There's so much anger behind the false loves that our culture presents. Like, you must honor me this way. You must say these things, or else, right? And then in biblical love, when the Spirit works that in a person, like the humility, the tenderness, and the quietness of that love is quite striking. And beautiful to behold. So
I love that, Mary. I mean, there's a place within Christianity, right, for you know, Jesus turns over, right, the tables in the temple. There's a place for all of those things. I get nervous because I don't think it's a place for me, given my temperament, right? I would love to go around flipping over tables, so I probably should never be the person doing that. That's something, Mary, you can do. But you know, I was thinking as you were talking, it is a fascinating thing when you challenge persons whose idol is weak, right? Whose idol is this finite, you know, paper mache kind of idol. When you challenge it, anger is a natural response. Bitterness, hatred, vitriol, it's a natural response. And as you were talking, I was thinking, like, man, I've spent my entire Christian life being challenged, right, by others, right? Challenging the existence of God, challenging the resurrection of Christ, challenging the veracity of Scripture, challenging all of those things. And my natural reaction isn't anger, hatred, vitriol. So there is something different, right, about knowing Jesus, him being the center of your life, him being Lord, Savior, God, and these other false things being Lord. The reactions are, I think, naturally supposed to be different.
Absolutely.
I don't know. I want to think that through. I want to think about that a little more.
Well, I want to hear it when you do, so let us know. Yeah. Joshua, what else do you want from the good doctor?
David, talk to us a little bit more about Providence Christian College.
Yeah, so, you know, Providence Christian College, we are proud of being small. We're also proud, actually, of our location. I lived for 12 years in kind of, you know, a Bible Belt area of the country, and my wife and I had a really hard time getting plugged into Christian communities there. The people were wonderful. This is not speaking about any negatively about any of them. They had really established communities, and kind of everybody's a Christian, right? You know, everybody calls themselves a Christian. What's fascinating about being where Providence is in Pasadena, California. So it's not LA proper. It's a very, very nice, relatively very safe area. But, you know, California is more hostile to Christianity in an explicit vocal way than a lot of other parts of the culture. And here's something that my wife and I experienced. We were dumbfounded. Within 3 months of arriving to Providence, we found ourselves in more intimate Christian communities than we have found ourselves in 12 years in other parts of the country. So I've been trying to figure out why is that. I think part of it is that if you call yourself a Christian in California, there's a cost to it. You better be serious. You're not going to call yourself a Christian if you're not serious about it, if you're not dedicated. And so one of the things that we've seen, and maybe this is part of what's happening at Providence, is that our students are just serious. They're so serious about loving God. They're serious about their faith. They're serious about academics. They're serious about community. Those are the three areas that I think are like the most important areas to develop when you're at college. Academics, spiritual growth, spiritual maturity, and community, right? And all of those things we're seeing here, and I think our size, our smallness, perhaps our location is actually playing a significant role. You know, Providence is a very liberal arts college, right? We are classically, our orientation is towards the classical liberal arts. We have an honors program called the Witherspoon Honors Program. It's run, the director of that program is Professor Paul Jimenez. You referenced him earlier. Unbelievable, unbelievable guy, unbelievable family. And that program is, it's a great books program that sort of serves as, I like to think of it as serving as the scaffolding for the rest of the program. So the students in the honors program, they're still in the regular academic program of the institution, but they're adding to that these deep dives into the greatest writings, the greatest thinkers, greatest writers in Western civilization. What's really amazing about that program is that every student in the program has an automatic 75% tuition scholarship, making Providence one of, if not the most affordable Christian college in all of California. As I've been looking at other Christian colleges and whatnot all over the country, we're actually one of the most affordable Christian colleges in the nation, right? Even if you add in room and board, we're very, very affordable. I love that our students live in apartments, right? We don't have traditional dorms. The college runs apartment complexes right across the street from where the academic building is. And so our students live in apartments. And I think that that must contribute to their maturation, right? So, you know, they're learning how to cook. They're doing their own laundry. They're learning how to clean a full apartment. Obviously, the roommate stuff, all of that helps with their maturation as well. Lastly, I want to say that, man, we have like 5-6 churches that are basically within walking distance of the college, all incredibly solid churches. At the church that I go to, I mentioned earlier, I'm PCA now. The church that my wife and I go to, it's about a half a mile from here. We walk to it every Sunday morning. If we're running late, sometimes we do drive. About 15 students, I think, on average, attend our church. They're heavily involved in the church, and the church adores them, takes great care of them. We've got about the same number of kids at an OPC church just up the road. We've got roughly the same number of kids at a non-denominational or independent Reformed church down the road in our building, right? We rent out a ton of space to an ACNA church called Vintage. It's a wonderful church. And they invite our students to participate in the life of the church. So we've got just so many amazing things going. Our students, you know, it's demonstrable. Providence students leave here, continue to serve the Lord, continue to love Jesus, and they enter into exciting fields. We send a lot of students into law school. We've got a philosophy, politics, and economics program that I think is actually the best kind of pre-law program. It's an excellent program for law, public policy, politics, nonprofits, and of course, you know, economics, things like that. It's a phenomenal program. And then we've got a biblical and theological studies program that seminaries, I can document this, right? This isn't just me talking. I can demonstrate this. Seminaries regularly tell us that the students we send out of our biblical and theological studies program, the students we send to seminaries, they tell us all the time that they are usually head and shoulders above in terms of preparation for seminary, everyone else in their cohort. We hear that regularly. We have an education program. We have 100% track record in placing our students into teaching positions immediately upon graduation. Our education program is solid. I mean, it is just a well-oiled machine. We have a bunch of Christian high schools, Christian elementary schools, classical schools in our network that are begging us to send them more and more and more and more teachers. And that's in California and also out of California. So we send teachers into Arizona, Washington, Oregon, Colorado, Texas, you know, all over the West and the Southwest. We have a lot of really, really solid programs here. Honestly, it's the best college I've ever been associated with. It really is just an incredible place to be.
Well, had I thought to say this in the introduction, I have been waiting to have David on this podcast we've been thinking about it for months. I've been anticipating it for days, and I am ending this podcast just overjoyed, David, with the time that you were able to spend with us. I'm delighted to have my daughter at Providence, to have her under your influence, your beautiful wife's influence as someone who helps in the apartments and has just done such a lovely job in discipling with her own Christian love and just beautiful care for all of the students. And I could sit and talk to you for hours. It's just been wonderful. So thank you so much for this time. To all of our listeners, David, can you tell our listeners really quickly before we wrap up, if they're interested in more information about Providence Christian College for their own students as parents, or if we have young adults who are considering college right now, where do they reach out? How do they get a hold of you guys about applying or visiting campus?
Yeah, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity too. I really appreciate it. Love the conversation, and I could do this for hours and hours and hours. I would say first, they can go to providencecc.edu. That's our website, providencecc.edu. Also, I highly encourage them all to contact me, alexander@providencecc.edu. That's my email address, alexander@providencecc.edu. You can also find me on our website. Click on my picture, and I'm pretty sure my email address will pop up automatically. You can also request information. So if you go to the website, look over to the top left corner, there's those three bars, right? The menu bars, click on those and you can request information. I think that'll take you probably 3 seconds to do.
Fantastic. Thank you. And then Joshua, can we put those links in the show notes also for people? Okay, so we're going to make it as easy as possible for you to get in contact with Providence. And Lord willing, in future years, we'll be able to do some more events with you guys. It was just an absolute pleasure spending that time with you guys in August. And every one of our speakers thought that it was absolutely wonderful and a wonderful audience. So look for information of that. As always, to our listeners and those of you who are watching on YouTube, we would ask you please to like this episode, to subscribe to the show. That helps us with the algorithm. It's just something that everyone who broadcasts this way has to deal with. We're always trying to deal with the algorithm. So please do like and subscribe. If you want more information from us, if you have questions or substantive comments, we read all of those. Leave them in the comments below, or you can email us at office@truthexchange.com. Office@truth, the letter X, and change.com. We cannot exist without you. We love all of you and thank you so much for spending this time with us today. And David, thank you again, Dr. Alexander, for just sharing your story with us. I did not know your testimony, and I love that Christ, through his just grace and the work of his Spirit, turns us into people who have backgrounds that sometimes it's painful to talk about, but that are a part of the story of turning us into family who love one another. And I am so glad that you shared all of that with us, and it's to his glory. So thank you. And until next week, everyone, we'll see you soon.